Okay, so Chris is not here, but I imagine he'll be here. He didn't let me know that he wasn't coming, so all right, let's see. Maybe we'll put something else on. Yeah, I'll just play something else from this wonderful Idan Rachel project. We just listened to Im Telech, If You Go. Let's do let's do that one. This is fun. Brum faya he grungala de Takruno bank na puna yise Brum faya he grungala de Takruno bank na puna yise
Dang boom. listen together to that 45. Now it only reminds you how I lied. Better go change it. Settled in your home, safe from outside. You don't settle for any more alibis. Too many taken. You won't ride home.
Their misgivings.
from felines and turtles and try not to hurt us. Find a four-legged friend for the best dividends. Best dividends.
rock and roll music and why I preach against it. I believe that it is a contributing factor to our juvenile delinquency.
DJ Easy Ed's Variety Hour. 120 minutes of rockabilly, hillbilly, old country, 50s R&B, and vintage rock and roll.
I know what it does to you.
Friday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m., alternating with Steve Harnish and the Bingo Show. Only here on WMFO in Medford.
If you talk to the average teenager of today and you ask them what it is about rock and roll music that they like, the first thing they'll say is the beat, the beat, the beat.
Want some now? Just search the web for DJ Easy Ed's Variety Hour to find the website, Blogspot, Facebook and MySpace pages, and Apple iTunes podcasts. Tufts Freeform Radio, 91.5 on your FM dial, and WMFO.org on the web.
It even vibrates like real.
Done. We just knew it made no sense to be carrying on this way. But it felt so good to let the water wash our masks away. Laughing at a joke no one else thinks is funny. Cheesecake for dinner, steak for dessert. I'm finally awake, no more faking it, honey. Even if it means I'll get hurt. I met myself the other day when I was hanging out with you, dancing in the rain with my hair freshly done. We both knew it made no sense to be carrying on this way, but it felt so good to let the water wash our masks away.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Hello, sir.
They're getting closer.
Oh, yeah? Watch this.
Watch what?
And now, before the next show starts, let's enjoy an intermission. You'll find our snack bar chock full of good things to eat and drink. Tasty, tempting hot dogs, thirst-quenching soft drinks, fresh, crunchy popcorn, a complete assortment of delicious candy, and a full line of cigarettes. You've plenty of time, so visit the snack bar now. A tasty treat will double your enjoyment of the show. For your convenience, we shall keep you informed of the remaining intermission time, 3 minutes before the next show starts.
Good afternoon, Medford, Massachusetts. My name's Chris Earle. The show is Watch This. I'm here with Winston Kidd today, and we are going to do all Quentin Tarantino soundtracks and movies and a little bit of discussion. Hope all's well here in the city of Medford. We're going to start you right up with Reservoir Dogs. We'll be back in a moment to talk about it. It's WMFO Watch This in Medford, Massachusetts. Thanks for listening to your Freeform station.
Mr. Pink.
Who cares what your name is?
Yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name.
Let's go to work.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight. I got the feeling there's something right.
What happens if the manager won't give you the diamonds?
Cut off one of his fingers. The little one.
I'm just scared in case I fall out of the chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
If they hadn't done what I told them not to do, they'd still be alive.
It's so hard to keep the smile from my face. I'm all over the place.
You're acting like a first-year thief. I'm acting like a professional.
And you flip me off a coin, slap you on my back and say,
choice we've been doing 10 years. They can ask me to promote. Ain't no choice at all.
Bam.
Bam. Bam, 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 bam.
You're under arrest, sugar.
Harvey Keitel, Tim Roth,
Chris Penn, Steve Buscemi, Lawrence Tierney, and Michael Madsen. They're the Reservoir Dogs.
Hey, Joe, want me to shoot this guy?
Kate Bailey's Super Sounds of the 70s weekend just keeps on coming with this little ditty that reached up to 21 in May of 1970. The George Baker selection, Little Green Bag. Turn the Beat Around by Vicky Sue Robinson, Heaven on the Seventh Floor, La Freak by Chic, Fly Robin Fly by The Silver Connection, and now number 5.
You're listening to Watch This on WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. My guest today, Mr. Winston Kidd. How you doing, Winston?
Always good. My mic's not on.
Yeah, I got you. Hold on. So Reservoir Dogs is 1992 American independent film written and directed by Quentin Tarantino. In his feature-length debut, considered one of the most important independent films of all time since it pretty much launched his career, and it also got a whole bunch of other people to come out and create films at the time. Some did better than others over the years. How you doing, Winston? Sorry about that.
Got the mic on. I am always good.
There we go. So the first one is The Reservoir Dogs. He had done a short film before, and he had planned on doing this in 16mm with his friends, but apparently he had a friend of a friend who passed along the script to Harvey Keitel, and he jumped on board with it, gave him some money, and it gave him the credibility to actually go and cast members like Tim Roth and Steve Buscemi from New York City to get on board the film. It's pretty good. I rewatched it last night in preparation for the show. So tell us a couple of trivia items you found about Reservoir Dogs. Or how do you feel about Reservoir Dogs? You like it?
Oh, yeah, it was a great
Quentin Tarantino
movie.
Movies.
He was, you know, when he wrote that, he was living on some guy's couch.
Yeah.
And had no idea, you know, that he was going to be able to write. And he wrote that. It got over into Cannes.
Yep.
And just basically rocked the Cannes Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went to France and nobody and came back a superstar.
I know. It's pretty amazing, huh?
And just that the epitome of the overnight success.
And all of us men at one point have living on some other man's couch. And I think it does actually help out a little bit in wanting to get off that couch and make a life for yourself. Get a little money in your pocket.
Yeah. It helps with the motivation.
Mm-hmm,
it's
mm-hmm.
like, I know where I am right now and I know I shouldn't be here.
Right.
So one of the really interesting things, and you know, he made Reservoir Dogs. He wrote it, and he made it with his own money, with the residuals he made off of a Golden Girls appearance as an Elvis impersonator.
Yeah, that's pretty good, yeah.
And he wrote it in such a way because they wouldn't let him direct True Romance, and they wouldn't let him direct Natural Born Killers. So he made sure Reservoir Dogs was written in one place so he could direct it.
Yeah.
And he wanted control, and that's what he got.
And it's interesting about it where it's a heist movie. I mean, when it comes down to it, it's a heist movie. It's about jewelry heist, and they're robbing it. And it's, but you never actually see the heist happen. It's all in the warehouse. And probably one of the most chilling parts of the movie to me, and the one that's memorable, is not the one that most people think of is the torture scene to this next song that we've got coming in. Where Vic Vega, who is he's kind of an early version of Vincent Vega in Pulp Fiction. He was supposed to be the same character, but there's a little bit of a difference here where the character gets killed off at two different points in two different movies. So he's supposed to be like the spiritual successor to Vincent Vega, but when he grabs the policeman and he puts him in the warehouse and he starts to torture him to this song in the background, which is Stuck in the Middle with You, there's one point where he he has a straight razor, which you said was also seen in another movie, right?
That's right. The Kill straight Bill. Razor that Mr. Blonde has is the same one that the bride uses to cut her ropes when she's buried in Kill Bill.
That's pretty cool. Yeah, and that's quite a bit later, too. It's probably about 10 years later where he ends up making Kill Bill in 2003. But there's a point where he slashes the policeman, and then he goes outside. And as soon as he goes outside, the music just stops. Just like that. It just stops. And you hear kids playing outside, and you see him go to his car, and he goes into the trunk and pulls something out from the trunk. And then you go back inside, music's back on again. So for a moment, everybody's safe. When this crazy guy goes and he gets his gas tank from the trunk, and then as soon as he comes back inside, he's dancing and starts pouring gas all over this guy. And it's brutal. I mean, it's really brutal. But one of the things that's interesting about this movie, too, is you never actually see him do what he does to the policeman. They take the camera and they move it away. But most people, if you talk to them, would say, I hated that part where they showed him taking this guy's ear off of his head.
Yeah, because your mind fills in the blanks.
Yeah, it's pretty creepy.
Yeah, he just... and that was... Mr. Blonde was played by Michael Madsen, and in an interview he was saying how, you know, during all the rehearsals, Quentin says, you know, you're going to dance around the cop with the razor maniacally, and he's like, Quentin, I don't know what to do.
Right.
Tarantino's like, don't, we'll do it in the day of the shoot. They get to the day of the shoot, and he's like, I don't know what to do. And they play this, and so he just starts to go with it. And he goes, I didn't hear a cut, so I kept going with it. And
he
slices off the guy's ear,
mm-hmm.
and Quentin's telling him, throw it. He goes, I didn't want to throw it, so I talked into it,
Yeah.
and then I threw it.
Yeah.
And he's like,
he did Actor's Choice.
Yeah. And the he's like, you know, and they're, that's all that studio blood, so it's syrup.
Right.
And he was hugging Tim Roth at the end of the day, and they stuck together.
Yeah.
And they and the wardrobe people were like, don't pull too hard because you'll rip the shirts. And there was no money for wardrobe. He said, right. In fact, we all wore our own suits. He says, that was my suit.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Steve Buscemi is wearing black jeans. He's not even wearing suit pants.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Orange there is Tim Roth, and he has probably the hardest role because he's dying the entire movie. So he's in between either being passed out or like writhing and screaming in pain. So and if you haven't seen the movie before, there's a little spoiler in there that I don't want to give away. The ear part isn't a big thing to give away because most people heard about that, pun intended, with the hearing. But with Tim Roth, he's basically on the floor, and he's writhing and screaming in pain the whole time, and he's just covered in blood. He's just covered in that syrup. So I'm surprised he didn't stick to the warehouse ground. But it's a cool movie, and one of the things I got to mention, because we're playing the soundtracks, and I like to play the soundtracks while we're doing a little movie discussion and a little bit of analyzing of the movies. Like this in the background is Coconut by Harry Nilsson, and it was a big hit, or a minor hit. Most of the things on the soundtrack are minor hits.
Right.
They're all top 40 things. So if you were around in the time, you recognized the song, and for the most part, you were like, oh my God, I haven't heard this song since I was a kid. And this is interesting is in the fact that the characters actually talk about these songs, as or at least K. Billy Supersound of the 70s is playing a weekend full of old 70s hits that you haven't heard before. So they're all into listening to this radio station, and they'll mention a few of them that show up in the movie, but they all have something to do with the scene that they're being played in. So in this one, it's played at the end of the movie, and it sounds like just a silly song about a coconut, but if you listen to the lyrics, it talks about a bellyache, which is Tim Roth the entire movie, which is him dying of a stomach shot, you know, through the entire movie. And it's basically kind of like this lighthearted song at the very end of the movie saying to the people out in the audience and also the characters in the movie, hey, this was just a movie. Didn't we have fun? Rather than it was just this violent gore fest that, you know, everybody, you know, gets critical over sometimes. There's a few things in Quentin Tarantino's. Well, I think he's great, but I don't think he's perfect. I think sometimes he doesn't really grow as a director as over the years. And there's always his problem of putting bad actors in roles like himself in this one. Yeah. He's not in it very long, but he's not very good in it. The lines that he has, you can tell who's the non-professional actor sitting at the table the whole time.
To exactly that point, in Pulp Fiction, the Vincent Vega part was written for Michael Madsen.
Yeah.
Who is not exactly an A-list actor.
Right, yeah.
I mean, he's marginal at best.
But also at the time, other than Look Who's Talking, which was a pretty big hit, but it also had Bruce Willis and Ted Danson attached to it, Travolta wasn't. He was kind of gone from A to B at that point. Resurgence to his career, which he's done a number of times with his movies with a bunch of different actors and actresses.
That's true.
Yeah. But, it's pretty cool. So, like, these other ones, Stuck in the Middle with You is obvious. You know, you're stuck with this psychopath that's just pouring gas and torturing this policeman. And it's just a really cool way. And it's also a precursor to the movie that just came out this past year, which I actually loved. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which I think is probably his second best movie. I just loved it. I thought it was great. And we could talk about it in a little bit. But in that movie, it is constantly Brad Pitt, Leonardo DiCaprio, and in the background is the radio station through the whole movie. So it's set in 1969, and back then, and you grew up through there, and I grew up through the 70s, The radio was almost always on wherever you went. Like if you were going to a place, you know, with your friends or if you're at a workplace, people pretty much had like a major station on in the background that everybody listened to. And it kind of made out the soundtrack of your life. You know, you were just going from thing to thing with music in the background. A lot of people would talk about almost like, hey, did you see The Sopranos last night on HBO? You know, when that became a thing, everybody was buying HBO to see The Sopranos. And in this case, you know, you'd have the radio station on and they would always talk. People would call into the radio station. It became part of their lives. The DJs were part of their lives. They'd talk through the songs like what we're doing now, you know, and have it on in the background. So we're moving on to Pulp Fiction here in 1994. Got that on the background. But Reservoir Dogs, one of my favorites. It was cool rewatching it, and it was interesting seeing all the other little things that Quentin Tarantino does in each of his movies. I'm kind of seeing a theme where he's got 9 movies out. He said he's going to do one more, and that's it. They're all movies about other movies that he's seen. So his what's happening along the way is he's taking a bunch of obscure movies that he loved, like as a kid or working in the video store, and he's remaking them. But he's not remaking one movie. He's remaking like 10 to 12 of them at a time. So this was his version of the heist movie. And Pulp Fiction that comes up here is another callback to a whole bunch of other movies that he liked as a kid, including the heist and, you know, the mostly characters. It's character-driven.
Yeah.
You know, so you got the 2 mob guys, and what do they talk about? You know, in this one you have Jules, and you have Vincent Vega, which is Samuel L. Jackson and John Travolta, and they're having kind of this random discussion about hamburgers, you know, at the beginning of the movie. It's like, well, what do these guys talk about? And they talk about hamburgers, you know? And you saw a little bit of it in Reservoir Dogs at the beginning where they're talking about Madonna and stuff. So Quentin Tarantino, he's not a huge action movie guy. I think he's more of a dialogue and character guy, and kind of like goes with the flow of what he's going to do with those characters in a certain amount of hours. So what'd you think about Pulp Fiction?
I loved it.
Yeah.
It was crazy. It was, you know, Travolta making a comeback. I thought Bruce Willis had a great part in that.
Yeah, Christopher Walken.
Ving Rhames.
Yeah, Ving Rhames.
I mean, just by that time, it's like he could cast whoever he wanted.
So if the ear is what you think about with Reservoir Dogs, what would be what you think about in Pulp Fiction when you think about the first thing?
Oh, geez, that's tough because it's been beat into us so much that, you know, the dance with the Batman eyes was
right.
Certainly up towards the top.
Yeah.
Me personally, I love the Ving Rhames monologue after after he gets rescued.
Yeah, me too. Yeah,
it just like, I mean, it's so freaking powerful.
Yeah, I think the main thing with Pulp Fiction is just there's so many shocks, and I remember seeing it in the theater at the time. The biggest shock wasn't really the cellar scene, but more when Mia overdoses, and
oh,
she
yeah.
gets the. And that was a killer. That was like, oh my God, just the ultimate piercing. You have like all these people that are like, you have Roseanne Arquette, who's like a girlfriend that's like got all these different piercings. And then she overdoses and they have to give her the adrenaline shot.
Yep.
And they show the adrenaline shot on screen. Most people have seen Pulp Fiction, so I don't think any of this is much of a giveaway either. But that scene was just, man, crazy. But over time, we've become so conditioned to see stuff like that now, not only in like movies, but also like Game of Thrones, all the HBO stuff.
Yep.
So that isn't as powerful anymore when you see something like that. But at the time, I'm like, oh my God, they're stabbing her in the heart with a needle.
With a needle.
You know, it was crazy.
And, you know, to your point, they have all those different shocks in the same movie.
Yeah.
He was like bombarding you with, you know, with adrenaline rocking.
Yeah.
Movies.
And also the samurai picture comes in here too with Bruce Willis when he's finally like looking around. What can he take? A baseball bat, a chainsaw, a rifle? No. He's going to take the samurai sword.
which is then ties into Kill Bill.
Yep.
And
yep.
everything else.
See, that would be interesting to see whether or not that sword actually a sword that's in Kill Bill. If not the bride's sword, it could be somebody else's sword in there. It could be the bad guys, the girls, or or you know, any of them in there.
Is it a Hanzo Hani sword?
Right, it has to be Japanese steel, right? Yes. Yeah. It has to be Japanese steel. So this was a great, great movie. This is my favorite. This is Pulp Fiction. I think it's awesome, and every time it's on, I got to watch it. The dialogue in it is just fantastic. And like you said, all the people, you know, Travolta and Jackson, Ving Rhames. The ones that I think of right away are Travolta and Samuel L. Jackson, because I think, in a way, that's you and your buddy in the car. Like, we could be talking about that, yeah, you know, yeah. Not on our way to a hit, but like on the way to McDonald's. Yeah. We could be talking about Burger King.
On the way home from the hit. And that was another shock when he blew the kid's head off in the back seat.
Marvin, yeah, yeah. I shot Marvin's face off.
It's like, what'd you do that for?
Yeah. In the background is the dialogue that Samuel L. Jackson usually gives before each of his kills. Ezekiel 25:17. This was interesting because it's like, it's a whole bunch of different things thrown together in order to make the speech. But I liked how you had Samuel L. Jackson, who kind of wants to get out, and you actually see him get out pretty much, right? Yeah. And we never see his character again in the other movies that he's made. But Travolta decides not to get out, and it's to his detriment because he's kind of on his, you know, his last jobs, and he shouldn't be. And eventually it ends up costing him his life with Bruce Willis taking him out.
Interesting story that... all of these movies, these initial movies, were picked up by Miramax.
Yeah.
So.
This is the first time that he's working with the Weinsteins too, right?
This is the first time he's working with the Weinsteins, and Harry calls up the producer and says, "I'm reading the script. You kill the main character during the middle of the movie."
Yeah.
I says, "Keep reading." He says, "No, no. You can't kill the main character in the middle of the movie." He says, no, keep reading. He says, oh. He says, oh, he comes back? He says, yeah, he comes back. Is it a happy ending? Yeah, Harvey, it's a happy ending. Okay, keep going.
That's what Harvey likes. Yeah. He likes happy endings.
Obviously, literally and figuratively.
That's going on right now, right? That trial that should hear something from him soon, right?
Yeah, I don't know how long that trial is going to take.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think they were, he was, you know, somebody was pushing him up. He was using a walker to kind of go up.
Oh, yeah, I saw. Yeah, he's looking old and
he's trying to look
old and innocent. Yeah, give me a break.
And innocent. And
no, he'd be innocuous. He'd be going for the happy as soon as he got out, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He'd be joining Bob Kraft down in Florida for a couple of nights in the bathhouse.
Well, I mean, he's got to get out to help set up the next Epstein Island.
Yeah. Can you imagine having that much money and then just being, you know, just all of a sudden you're in jail with nothing? It's pretty much like that scene in Raging Bull when Robert De Niro's had everything and then he's got nothing because he's making out with like some underage girl in this club and he starts punching the walls and hitting his head on the wall. I'm like, oh my God, it's crazy. That's a heartbreaking scene in the movie. But it's like, yeah, hey, did what he did. Money corrupts, power corrupts. Everybody wants it. But hey, he produced some good movies. He distributed some good movies.
He did it that.
So the other scene, you gotta give props to Christopher Walken. It was to me this the Gold Watch scene where it's just him. Like, he's the only actor on the scene for about 2 or 3 minutes, and he's giving the watch to the little kid telling his story is just so intense and so funny. And it's just fantastic. The only other scene I could think of that's great with, I mean, Christopher Walken's always great, but you think of True Romance when he's got Dennis Hopper and he's basically tortured him in the chair and he goes through a little monologue with him there, too.
And the other thing is that the tie-in there is Christopher Walken in Pulp Fiction is playing Captain Koontz.
That's right. Yeah.
And then that's brought up again in Django, and he's not. It's brought up as on the wanted poster as Crazy Craig Koontz.
Yeah. So it's like a spiritual successor to that one. Yeah.
Predecessor to that one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Predecessor to that one because Django's set in the past in the Western. So. Harvey Keitel shows up again as Winston Wolfe, which is a great first name.
Yeah, gotta love that first name.
And here's a point, too. Like, okay, so if you remember when they introduced Winston, he's with Julia Sweeney, who was from Saturday Night Live. So to me, who watched Saturday Night Live and having her in that role as, like, Winston's girlfriend, and she wasn't a very good actress in the movie. She was fine on Saturday Night Live, but I was just like, well, this is obviously somebody that Quentin is banging that he threw in the movie, you know? Or maybe Harvey Weinstein, you know? You never know. But it's just like, those things are just, you know, a little bit off. And then when Quentin shows up and he's like in his coffee and his pajamas, his robe, you know? I mean, that scene's kind of fun, but it's just like, it's not very good acting by Quentin, you know? It's like, yeah, you could do better. And that's, it's almost like he wants to throw it in there just so it's like, hey, this is an A-list movie, but it's a B movie. You know, it's like it's a B movie with a lot of money. You know, it's like, I'm going to make my favorite B movies, but I'm going to amp them up a lot and, you know, just spend a whole lot of money on things.
I prefer to think of it more like he's taking the tack that the Japanese artisans do when they're knitting something beautiful. They always knit in an imperfection because perfection is reserved for
God. There you go. Yeah, nice. That's good. Good analogy. What do you think about the dynamic between Bruce Willis and Fabienne?
Oh,
yeah. So Fabienne is just very much likes to sleep. She likes to have sex, and she likes to have baby talk with her boyfriend. And that's all we really know about Fabienne.
She's you know, obviously she's a little bit mentally challenged. And,
right.
You know, and Bruce Willis's character is, you know, falling in love with her, taking care of her, and you know, and you see that when he gets really upset with her for forgetting to get the watch,
right?
And then, but he doesn't, you know, he's upset and he doesn't really take it out on her because he knows he can't. She did the best she could.
She's like a little puppy.
Yeah, she did the best she could, and he's going to take care of it.
But the interesting thing too, to me, is the dynamic where Fabienne is really Bruce Willis's only kryptonite. And that you never see anybody go through her to get to him. And he ends up getting away in the end with her. And they're the only ones that pretty much go off into the sunset on the chopper.
Yep.
But you see that there's a weakness there. So in the future, if anything happened with Bruce Willis, it would probably be he's going to be hurt through Fabienne versus all these other guys and all the crap that he's gone through.
Well, that's a really good point.
Yeah. Pretty interesting scene, too, with Bruce Willis when they first start the gold watch. They have him in a cab and he's talking to a taxi driver, and she's kind of getting off a little bit on the fact that he killed this guy in the ring, and she's kind of a creepy character. But the way that they do it is just, it looks like it's filmed like in somebody's living room, you know. The taxi, it's like, it looked like pretty much like Judd Hirsch Taxi, where they have a little thing in the background where you think you're driving in the taxi but you're really not, you know. And there's just some moments like that, you know, in Pulp Fiction, where it's like, okay, it's a movie, you know? It's this is movie magic right now. And then there's others that are just, like, super intense. Like, when he gets into the car crash, when Ving Rhames is crossing the street.
Yeah.
And then he gets into the car crash, and it's just super intense. And then, you know, the girl gets shot while he's trying to run. He's running down Ving Rhames. It's just crazy. You know, there's just moments that are just, like, completely very realistic and just bring you back. I just think there's a really good pace to his films. He does a good job, like, editing it and figuring out, okay, we're going to have it be kind of quiet, then it's going to be super intense.
Right, and he does a great job with story cuts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, parallel stories and playing with time and playing with, you know, all the different aspects of the film.
Yeah. The restaurant that they go to, too, Uma Thurman and Travolta, when they go to Jackrabbit Slim's.
Yes.
I mean, what a great setting. It's like everybody would want to go to this place for dinner to hang out. It's like super cool. And he has his $5 milkshake, which at the time was a lot of money.
It's a lot of money.
You could get like 10 milkshakes for $5 in 94. You know, maybe not 10, but still, you would get more than one. And Steve Buscemi shows up as the waiter in the diner. He plays Buddy Holly. That's right. He's only in it for a very short time, but there's that link, too, from Reservoir Dogs. I thought Steve Buscemi was great in Reservoir Dogs.
Oh, yeah,
he was.
He was
awesome. Yeah, I mean, he was the only one with the brain in his head and stayed focused the whole time. So we're moving on into Jackie Brown. I got to mention the soundtrack of Pulp Fiction, though, like that last one when they're in the cellar and they open up, you know, and the gimps down there, like all of a sudden there's this guy like dressed up in leather that they got on a chain over in the corner and they play this guttural saxophone, you know, when it's just like you're down in the cellar with these guys for a while where you have Bruce and Marcellus Wallace just stuck with them.
Yeah.
And here's these two alpha males just stuck.
In a really bad spot.
And in that, you know, when they showed that scene too, same thing, the shocks of all the stuff that happens in the gold watch is just crazy.
And you're not really, you know, you're not prepared for that. Hollywood didn't, you know, before this, Hollywood really didn't touch that kind of stuff.
No, not at all. So you're sitting there and you're like, oh, how'd they get away with that? You know, it was a little much. In the background, Jackie Brown. So after Pulp Fiction, he became superstar. Budget of $8 million, it made $213 million. It won the Palme d'Or at Cannes. And 3 years later, he came out with Jackie Brown, which is a very interesting movie. I actually, like I said, Pulp Fiction's my number one. But Jackie Brown is kind of like a slow burn. It's kind of like an enjoyable, expensive blaxploitation movie that he updates. Pam Grier's excellent in it, and you got Robert Forster in it, who's excellent. So he takes these, you know, not even B actors and actresses anymore. Their careers were over. And he takes them and puts them as stars in the movie and pretty much resurrects their careers.
In part because before he was writing all these movies, you know, he was living on somebody's couch. He was working in a video store, and all he did, he knows. People will sit there and tell you, Mike Madsen said in an interview, you know, if you think you know about film and about the actors in the film, he says, I'll watch people talk to Quentin, and Quentin sits there and shakes his head and then buries them with the amount of that he knows.
Yeah.
He knows everybody who did anything.
Yeah.
And so he saw all these people, and he brought him back because he knew what they could do.
Right. Well, he said when people ask him if he went to film school, he said, no, I went to films. I like to watch films. And that's pretty much it. He's sitting there, you know, as a kid and also working in the video store, just watching films all day, you know. No different kind of training course than anything else, you know. You're spending all that time. You know what? We watch a lot of movies. You and I both watch a lot of movies. And it's like, the stuff that you come up with when your friends, associates, coworkers, or whatever, when you talk about, hey, I saw a film last night, people remember movies differently. Or they don't remember them at all. You know, it's like, you could have somebody, like, I'll have my brother go to a movie and fall asleep halfway through, and it'll be like, yeah, it was okay. And it's like, to me, that critical analysis doesn't count because you didn't see the whole movie. But it is what it is. Everybody has a say when it comes to movies and what they like and what they don't. They saw enough of the movie where they can register, yeah, it was okay, I liked what I saw.
Yep.
But then there's other people that really dig in and analyze and are like, why did they use that particular wrapper on that hamburger that says Big Kahuna?
Yeah.
You know, why is that there? You know? Why are those red apple cigarettes showing up in every single Quentin Tarantino movie? So you mentioned you saw a couple other brand names or something. Saw a characters moving over. You see brand names
moving over. You've got there's an Earl McGraw character that's in Dusk to Dawn, Kill Bill, and Death Proof.
Oh yeah. Earl McGraw. Now, is it the same character or is it the same name? They never show him.
It's the same name, and it's not because he plays with the time.